Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we always look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. In an article from Ellen Brown, "Time to Break Up the Too Big to Fail Banks." Looming losses from the mortgage scandal dubbed Foreclosuregate may qualify as the sort of systemic risk that, under the new financial reform bill, warrants the breakup of the too-big-to-fail banks. The Kanjorski Amendment allows federal regulators to preemptively break up large financial institutions that, for any reason, pose a threat to U.S. financial or economic stability. Although downplayed by most media accounts and popular financial analysts, crippling bank losses from foreclosure flaws appear to be imminent and unavoidable. The defects prompting the robo-signing scandal are not mere technicalities, but are inherent to the securitization process. They cannot be cured. This deep-seated fraud is already explicitly outlined in publicly available lawsuits. There is, however, no need to panic, no need for TARP II, and no need for legislation to further conceal the fraud and push the inevitable failure of the too-big-to-fail banks into the future. Federal regulators now have the tools to take control and set things right. The Wall Street giants escaped the Volcker Rule, which would have limited their size, and the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, which would have broken up the largest six banks outright, but the financial reform bill has us covered. The Kanjorski Amendment, which slipped past lobbyists largely unnoticed, allows federal regulators to preemptively break up large financial institutions that pose a threat to U.S. financial or economic stability. The new Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC, probably didn't expect to have its authority called on quite so soon, but Representative Alan Grayson, Democrat from Florida, has just put the amendment to the test. At the beginning of the month, in a letter addressed to Geithner, Blair, Bernanke, Shapiro, Walsh, Gensler, DeMarco, and Matz, he asked for an emergency task force on foreclosure fraud. He said, "The liability here for the major banks is potentially enormous and can lead to a systemic risk. Fortunately, the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation includes a resolution process for these banks. More importantly, these foreclosures are devastating neighborhoods, families, and cities all over the country. Each foreclosure costs tens of thousands of dollars to a municipality, lowers property values, and makes bank failures more likely." Grayson sought a foreclosure moratorium on all mortgages originated and securitized between 2005 and 2008, until such time as the FSOC task force was able to understand and mitigate the systemic risk posed by the foreclosure fraud crisis. But last week, White House advisor David Axelrod downplayed the need for a national foreclosure moratorium, saying the administration was pressing lenders to accelerate their reviews of foreclosures to determine which ones have flawed documentation. "Our hope is this moves quickly and that this gets unwound very, very quickly," he said. According to Brian Moynihan, chief executive of Bank of America, The amount of work required is a matter of a few weeks. A few weeks will be through the process of double-checking the pieces of paper we need to double-check. Absurd, says critics such as Max Gardner III of Shelby, North Carolina. Gardner is considered one of the country's top consumer bankruptcy attorneys. This is not an oops. This is not a technical problem. This is not even sloppiness, he says. The problem is endemic, and its effects will be felt for years. Representative Grayson makes similar allegations. He writes, "The banks didn't keep good records, and there is good reason to believe in many, if not virtually all, cases during this period, they failed to transfer the notes, which is the borrower IOUs, in accordance with the requirements of their own pooling and servicing agreements. As a result, the notes may be put out of eligibility for a trust under New York law, which governs these securitizations. Potential cures for the note may, according to certain legal experts, be contrary to IRS rules governing REMICs,
Real Estate Mortgage Investment Conduit.
As a result, loan servicers and trusts simply lack standing to foreclose. The remedy has been foreclosure fraud, including the widespread fabrication of documents. There are now trillions of dollars of securitizations of these loans in the hands of investors. The trusts holding these loans are in a legal gray area, as the mortgage titles were never officially transferred to the trusts. The result of this is foreclosure fraud on a massive scale, including foreclosure on people without mortgages or who are on time with their payments. That raises the question, why were the notes not assigned? Grayson says the banks were not interested in repayment. They were just churning loans as fast as they could in order to generate fees. Financial blogger Carl Denninger says, "I believe a big part of why it was not done is that if it had been done, the original paperwork would have been available to the trustee and ultimately the MBS owners, who would have immediately discovered that the representations and warranties as to the quality of the conveyed paper were being wantonly violated." He says, "You can't audit what you don't have." Both are probably right. Yet these explanations seem insufficient. If it were just a matter of negligence or covering up dubious collateral, surely some of the assignments by some of the banks would have been done properly. Why would they all be defective? The reason the mortgage notes were never assigned may be that there was no party legally capable of accepting the assignments. Securitization, in its origin, was a tax avoidance procedure based on the formal difference between secured loans and sales. To qualify for the tax exemption, the conduits between the original lender and the investors could own nothing. The problem was nailed in a class action lawsuit recently filed in Kentucky titled Foster versus MERS GMAC et al. It's in the U.S. District Court, Western District of Kentucky. The suit claims that MERS, or MERS, and the banks violated the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a law originally passed to pursue organized crime. Bloomberg quotes Heather Boone McKeever, a Lexington, Kentucky-based lawyer for the homeowners, who said in a phone interview, "RICO comes in because the fraud didn't just happen piecemeal. This is organized crime by people in suits, but it is still organized crime. They created a very thorough plan." And I'll get back to this in a second. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm discussing an article by Ellen Brown regarding the banking fraud by the largest banks in an article called Time to Break Up the Too Big to Fail Banks. And I'm looking at a lawsuit complaint regarding allegations in a class action against organizations related to this fraud. So the complaint is saying the trusts coming to court are actually mortgage-backed securities, MBS. The servicers, like GMAC, are merely administrative entities which collect the mortgage payments and escrow funds. The MBS have signed themselves up under oath with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and the Internal Revenue Service as mortgage asset pass-through entities wherein they can never own the mortgage loan assets in the MBS. This allows them to qualify as real estate mortgage investment conduit, or REMIC, rather than an ordinary real estate investment trust, an REIT. As long as the MBS is a qualified REMIC, no income tax will be charged to the MBS. For purposes of this action, trust and MBS are interchangeable. And it goes on further. REMICS were newly invented in 1987 as tax avoidance measure by investment banks to file a REMIC, and in order to avoid 100% taxation by the IRS and the Kentucky Revenue Cabinet, an MBS REMIC could not engage in any prohibited action. The trustee cannot own the assets of the REMIC. A REMIC trustee could never claim it owned a mortgage loan. Hence, it can never be the owner of a mortgage loan. The lawsuit continues. Additionally, and important to the issues presented under this particular action, is the fact that in order to keep its tax status and to fund the trust and legally collect money from investors who bought into the REMIC, the trustee, or the more properly named custodian of the REMIC, had to have possession of all the original blue ink promissory notes and original allonges and assignments of the notes, showing a complete paper chain of title. And most importantly for the action, the trustee or custodian must have the mortgages recorded in the investor's name as the beneficiaries of the mortgage-backed securities in the year the MBS closed. So only the beneficiaries, the investors who advance the funds, can claim ownership. And the mortgages had to have been recorded in the name of the beneficiaries the year the mortgage-backed security closed. The problem is, who are the beneficiaries who advance the funds? In the securitization market, they come and go. Properties get sold and resold daily. They can be sliced up and sold to multiple investors at the same time, which investors could be said to have put up the money for a particular home that goes into foreclosure. MBS are divided into tranches according to the level of risk, typically from AAA to BBB. The BBB investors take the first losses on up to the AAAs, but when the REMIC is set up, no one knows which homes will default first. The losses are taken collectively by the pool as they hit. The BBBs simply don't get paid, but the pool is the trust, and to qualify as a REMIC trust, it can own nothing. So what happened here is that the lenders were trying to have it both ways, and to conceal what was going on, they dropped an electronic curtain over their sleight of hand, called Mortgage Electronic Registration System, or MERS. MERS is simply an electronic database. On its website and in assorted court pleadings, it too declares that it owns nothing. It was set up that way so that it would be bankruptcy remote, something required by the credit rating agencies in order to turn the mortgages passing through it into highly rated securities that could be sold to investors. According to the MERS website, it was also set up that way to save on recording fees, which means dodging state statutes requiring a fee to be paid to establish a formal record each time title changes hands. The arrangement satisfied the rating agencies, but it has not satisfied the courts. Real estate law dating back hundreds of years requires that to foreclose on real property, the foreclosing party must produce signed documents establishing a chain of title to the property, and that has not been done. Increasingly, judges are holding that if MERS owns nothing, it cannot foreclose, and it cannot convey title by assignment so that the trustee for the investors can foreclose. MERS breaks the chain of title so that no one has standing to foreclose. So now, 62 million mortgages are held in the name of MERS, a ploy that the banks have realized won't work. So plan B has been to try to fabricate documents to cure the defect. Enter the robo-signers, a small group of people signing thousands of documents a month, admittedly without knowing what was in them. Interestingly, it wasn't just one bank engaging in this pattern of cover-up and fraud, but many banks, suggesting a sort of organized crime that would qualify under the RICO statute. However, that ploy won't work either, because it's too late to assign properties to trusts that have already been set up without violating the tax code for REMIX, and the trusts themselves aren't allowed to own anything under the tax code. If the trusts violate the tax laws, the bank setting them up will owe millions of dollars in back taxes. Whether the banks are out the real estate or the taxes, they could well be looking at insolvency, posing the sort of serious systemic risk that would bring them under the purview of the new Financial Stability Oversight Council. So when looking at the foreclosure crisis, we're in a sense back to square one. While we're working it all out, an extended foreclosure moratorium probably is in the works. But this needn't be the economic disaster that some are predicting. Not if the FSOC is allowed to do its job. We've been here before, and not just in 2008. In 1934, Congress enacted the Fraser-Lemke Farm Bankruptcy Act to enable the nation's debt-ridden farmers to scale down their mortgages. The act delayed foreclosure of a bankrupt farmer's property for 5 years, during which time the farmer made rental payments. The farmer could then buy back the property at its currently appraised value over 6 years at 1% interest, or remain in possession as a paying tenant. Interestingly, according to Marion McKenna in Franklin Roosevelt and the Great Constitutional War, the federal government was empowered to buy up farm mortgages and issue non-interest-bearing treasury notes in exchange. Non-interest-bearing treasury notes are what President Lincoln issued during the Civil War when they were called greenbacks. The 1934 Act was subsequently challenged by secured creditors as violating the Fifth Amendment's due process guarantee of just compensation, a fundamental right of mortgage holders. Note that this would probably not be a valid challenge today, since there don't seem to be a legitimate mortgage holders in these securitization cases. There are just investors with unsecured claims for relief in equity for money damages. The Supreme Court voided the 1934 Act, and Congress responded with the Farm Mortgage Moratorium Act in 1935. The terms were modified, limiting the moratorium to a 3-year period, and the revision gave secured creditors the opportunity to force a public sale, with the proviso that the farmer could redeem the property by paying the sale amount. The act was renewed 4 times until 1949, when it expired. During the 15 years the act was in place, farm prices stabilized and the economy took off, retooling it for its role as global industrial power during the remainder of the century. We've come full circle again. We did not get it right in 2008, but with the newly empowered Financial Stability Oversight Council, we already have the ready-made vehicle to avoid another taxpayer bailout and to put too big to fail behind us as well. And this is an article by Ellen Brown. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Next, I'd like to get back to our discussion of on a series in the Boston Globe called Debtor's Hell. The article was focusing on two brothers who are collection firm owners in Massachusetts called the Goldstone Brothers. The Goldstone Brothers run separate companies, but that wasn't always the case. In 1992, Daniel Goldstone purchased a defunct collection law firm, renaming it Goldstone and Sudalter, and for several years, Chad worked for Daniel, proving especially adept at managing computer systems that have made debt collection a highly efficient business. But then in 1997, Chad Goldstone left the business to form Commonwealth Receivables. By then, Goldstone and Sudalter had been sued for bilking its largest client, Sears Roebuck & Company, out of more than $800,000, a case that would eventually lead to Daniel Goldstone's disbarment. Thereafter, Daniel Goldstone established Norfolk Financial. Even though they parted ways, the brothers remain alike in many respects as businessmen. Both buy delinquent credit card debt. Both employ similar collection tactics. Both work with small staffs from offices so poorly marked and out of the way that they are difficult to find. And though they are among the top filers of collection lawsuits in Massachusetts, neither company is registered as required by law with the State Division of Banks, which is charged with oversight of debt collection companies. Through their attorney, the Goldstones claim that they are exempt because they purchased the debts they tried to collect and do not collect debts for other creditors. But David J. Cotney, a chief operating officer for the Massachusetts Division of Banks, said every company in the state that collects defaulted debt, including Norfolk and Commonwealth, must be licensed. I don't know what basis they use to exclude themselves, he said. But what we're interested in is that the Goldstones, as debt buyers, are part of a growing trend that has transformed the collection industry. As the number of deeply indebted consumers has climbed, credit card companies and banks have become increasingly likely to sell off their uncollected accounts in bulk. This usually happens after 60 days when they charge off the accounts. Purchased by large debt-buying companies, the accounts are then repackaged and resold to smaller and smaller firms. So let's take an example. At 48, Joanne M. Johnson has been disabled with severe depression for 5 years. She gets by, barely, on $739 a month disability payment. The one thing she has of any monetary value is her mid-size sedan, a 1996 Plymouth Breeze. It is her only means of transportation to medical appointments and to the thrift shops and food banks she visits when she can't make ends meet. When Johnson became ill, she lost her job as a supervisor in the packing department of a local manufacturing firm, then defaulted on a credit card with a $500 limit. The Norfolk debt collection firm stepped in, bought the debt, and in 2004 filed a lawsuit against Ms. Johnson for $1,035, the debt plus 3 years' interest. Now, we see that the $500 limit has doubled. Now, this is when the process went awry. When Norfolk sued, it supplied the district court where Ms. Johnson lives with an address where Johnson never lived. The court put a hold on the suit when the notices came back undelivered. But for reasons court officials would not explain, the suit was then allowed to go forward after another notice was sent to Johnson at the same wrong address. And when Johnson didn't show up for her court date, Norfolk automatically won the case. Then, with a judgment in hand, Norfolk phoned Johnson and told her to appear in court to work out a payment schedule, according to Johnson. When she arrived, an attorney was there to answer questions. Johnson says she assumed he was a legal aid lawyer. In fact, he was a lawyer for Norfolk Financial, who, Johnson said, never identified himself. The lawyer asked her to fill out a financial statement, and then, before she could figure out what was happening, she found herself before a judge. I told the judge that once my car was paid off, I could pay $10 a month, she said.
All he said was, okay. He stamped the paper and said, you're finished. Nobody looked at me and said, we're going to take your car. But that's what happened. Less than 2 months after her court hearing, the Worcester County Sheriff deputies, who had no trouble finding Johnson's correct address, appeared at her home at about 8 a.m. and took her car. To get it back, Johnson would have had to pay a sheriff's fee, towing, and storage charges and interest, in addition to the $1,000 court judgment. The tally, $1,380. Again, from a $500 debt. With the help of a legal aid lawyer, Johnson filed for bankruptcy, but it was not until 3 months later, after a bankruptcy court judge threatened to jail the tow lot owner, that her car was returned damaged, Johnson says. Well, the trauma of losing her car sent Johnson into a downward emotional spiral. Within a week, she became suicidal and checked in at an emergency room in the local hospital. Then she was transferred by ambulance to a psychiatric ward where she spent 2 nights under a suicide watch. Now, while the record is clear that the court papers were not sent to Johnson's correct address, Daniel Goldstone said that his company had met the legal requirements for serving notice. As for the seizure, he said, Norfolk provided the course execution to the office of the county sheriff who caused Miss Johnson's car to be seized. Well, losing a car is bad enough, but how about losing a car, a house, and a job, which is what faced Michael Lynn Rackley and her husband after Norfolk Financial filed a lawsuit against Rackley and sent notice of the suit to the wrong address. Unlike Chad Goldstone, Daniel Goldstone often goes after the debtors' homes as well as their cars. Real estate records examined by the Globe show that over the last 4 years, Norfolk had put liens on more than 1,000 homes throughout the state of Massachusetts. Once a lien is placed on a home, it cannot be sold or even refinanced unless the lien holder is paid. And this is a common practice in many states, and in Iowa, it is a matter of law. If you're sued and there's a judgment against you in the county in which you own real estate, that is then a lien against that real estate. In this particular instance, Norfolk filed this lawsuit against Rackley for a $543 credit card debt. Court records showed that the notice sent to Rackley at the wrong address was returned undelivered, which should have prompted the district court to demand a correct address from the collector or dismiss the lawsuit. Nevertheless, Norfolk won an automatic judgment against Rackley because Rackley did not appear for a hearing she knew nothing about. Norfolk first came after Rackley's car and then her home. The county sheriff and the tow truck hauled away her Subaru, and as a result, Rackley had to quit her job delivering newspapers. Shortly thereafter, Goldstone placed the lien on the couple's home. The debtor had no choice but to pay off the entire debt of $1,038 with accumulated interest when the couple went to refinance their home. Rackley never got back her Subaru. After it was seized, the storage charges mounted daily, all the way to $5,600. And then the towing company sold the vehicle to recoup its costs, according to the sheriff's office. Rackley filed a federal lawsuit against Norfolk, who moved to have the suit dismissed, asserting that all of Rackley's claims are meritless as a matter of law. Rackley found the experience very frustrating. Norfolk, she said, is very underhanded. It's almost like they get a list of names and pick one out of a hat and say, okay, we're going after that one. So what we're seeing is case after case of these kinds of tactics, strategies, and often improper procedures to collect debt against people. And next week, we'll look at how the court system may be compromised in many places regarding debt collection. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, yet manageable life.